Now, this histology chapter is the only part of the term in which 156 is different from 181. I've said this before. Everything up to right at this moment, I would have taught exactly the same to a 181 class as I've taught to you. But now, instead of going on to photosynthesis, which is what the 181 students would do at this point, we're going to do histology. And that's because 156 is intended more for students who are going to work in human health. So you don't really need to know how plants work for human health. Histology is the study of tissues, whether no matter what kind of organisms you're working with, but we're going to talk about human histology. And remember where tissues are on the hierarchy of biological organization. Cells of different types make up tissues. Tissues of different types make up organs. And then you can go up from there. But your body's a complex structure. If you took a little sample of your body, though, no matter where you take that sample from, there's only four kinds of tissue that you're made out of. Okay, there's many more than four organs, but any given organ has at most four tissues in it. And these are the four types of tissue: epithelial tissue, connective tissue, muscle tissue, and nervous tissue. Now, of those four, two of these have a special property that the other two don't. Muscle tissue and nervous tissue are both said to be excitable tissues. Excitable tissues are tissues that are able to produce and transmit what are called action potentials. An action potential is an electrochemical signal. And this is how your nervous system works and how your muscular system works. So when we say your brain tells your body to do something, what it's doing is sending an action potential to that part of the body through neurons. Epithelial tissue and connective tissue cannot do that. So that's a special property of those two. And I think you probably know what muscle tissue and nervous tissue is just from their names. Epithelial tissue, or epithelium, is tissue that is specialized for more or less two major functions. It covers the surfaces of structures. For instance, the epidermis of your skin, the part that you can actually touch, is an epithelium, and that's obviously a covering. But epithelia also cover things inside of you, internal organs, or they line the internal space of hollow structures, like your digestive tract, for instance. The second major function that epithelia do are to form glands. So the tissue in glands that produce whatever the product of that gland is, whether it's a hormone or whatever, that's usually epithelial tissue doing that job. So muscle tissue obviously is for movement. Muscles are able to get short, and we'll talk more about them later, but that's their hallmark. Nervous tissue is all about communication. Nervous tissue sends impulses to organs, and it also receives incoming signals from your body and from the external surroundings. Epithelial tissue is for lining organs and for forming glands. And then there's connective tissue, which is the most diverse of the four tissues. Connective tissue is everything else, basically. And it might seem like it's a catch-all category, but really, even though it is everything else, every connective tissue really has some properties in common with all other connective tissues, which I'll talk about when we get to that. But we're going to start with epithelial tissue. So let's go to slide 2 and look at some important properties of epithelia. Epithelia is just the plural of epithelium. An epithelium has cellularity. Now, all tissues have some cells in them, but by cellularity, what I mean is that an epithelium is almost nothing but cells. Cells are bunched up right against each other. There's very little extracellular material in an epithelium. So it's chock full of cells. That's what I mean by cellularity. Polarity here does not refer to any electrical charge. Polarity, it just means, in general, polarity means having two ends that are different from each other, like the North and the South Pole. In this case, well, I'll show you a picture of what I mean by polarity, but an epithelium occurs as a layer because it covers things, right? That layer in its thickness has two different sides to it. That's the polarity I'm talking about. Avascularity, what does that mean? Well, the A prefix means not, right? So what does vascularity mean? Or what does vascular mean? Right, vascular is the adjective of vessel. So vascular means of vessels. Vascularity means having vessels, and therefore avascularity means not having vessels. An epithelium does not have blood vessels running through it. It has blood vessels that get close to it, but it doesn't actually run through the thickness of that layer that we call the epithelium. An epithelium is alive, at least some of the layers are in epithelia. Those cells are living, so they need blood for the same reasons that other cells need blood, in order to receive oxygen, in order to dump CO2, in order to receive nutrition, you know, all the things that blood does for all the other cells. So it's not the case that avascularity means that epithelia aren't using any of the things that blood bring to the other cells. It's just that epithelia are usually thin, not many cell layers thick. So just having a vessel beneath that surface still gets them close enough so that diffusion can bring those things to and from the cells of the epithelium. Epithelium itself, though, does not have vessels in it. And then regeneration refers to the fact that epithelial tissue is able to rebuild itself if it's destroyed. As long as there's a little bit remaining, an epithelium can use the surviving cells and heal. Now, you can't do this with all tissues. They're not the only tissues that regenerate, but for instance, you lose half your brain, the next day you're not going to just be normal. The brain's not going to grow back, but epithelia do. All right, let's look at a cartoon in slide 3 of an animal that just shows you epithelia occurring in different places. Don't worry about these names right now because we're going to go through these one by one. But this just shows you what I've already told you about epithelia. Their two main jobs are to line the surfaces of structures and to form glands. So let's go on to the particulars then. That's slide 4. This is the slide that really shows you a picture of the polarity I was talking about. Any epithelium has polarity. And the two different surfaces of an epithelium are called the apical surface and the basal surface. Now, basal is the adjective of base. An epithelium is attached to a surface, but it's attached to just one surface. You know, if you think of the thickness of its layer, there's two surfaces. You know, in this picture, the top surface and the bottom surface, but it can be arranged anyway. Anyway, there's two surfaces to a layer. Only one of those surfaces is actually attached to something else. So one is an attached surface, the other one is a free surface. The basal surface is the attached surface because it's attached to the base. And that base is really called a basement membrane, or basal lamina. They mean the same thing. And that is actually connective tissue. So an epithelium is connected to a different type of tissue, connective tissue, but that surface that's connected is the basal surface. The free surface, which is not connected, is called the apical surface, and apical is just the adjective of apex, which means tip. All right? So depends on where you are on the body. The apical surface of your skin is what you can actually touch. That's not attached to anything, right? That's the free surface. But if you think about an internal organ, the apical surface of your gut, for instance, the small intestine, that's inside. That's where the food actually touches, but it's not attached to anything. All right, that's the polarity. Now let's go on to slide 5 and classify epithelia. There's two fundamentally different ways to classify epithelia. And the one way of classifying them has nothing to do with the other way of classifying them. One way of classifying them is based on how many layers of cells there are in that epithelium. And that's all that scheme of classification cares about. And if that's all you care about is the number of layers, then there are two major possibilities, namely that the epithelium contains just one layer of cells, it's just one cell layer thick, or it's more than one layer thick. Well, if it is just one layer thick, then we call that whole epithelium a simple epithelium. Simple just means one layer thick. Two or more, instead of being simple, makes it stratified. Well, stratified means layered. A stratum is a layer. So stratified things are layered in general. A stratified epithelium has at least two layers of cells. Now, pseudostratified and transitional I'll get to when I get a picture, because it's better to explain those with a picture. But those are the two major ways to... those are the two major categories for characterizing epithelia based on number of layers. An entirely different way of categorizing epithelia does not have anything to do with how many layers there are, but instead it has to do with what the shape of the cells are in that epithelium. But not just anywhere in that epithelium, specifically in the apical layer, the free layer. Okay? Now, in a simple epithelium, there's only one layer, so that one layer is apical. But in a stratified epithelium, there's many layers, and those layers can have different shapes to the cells that make up those layers. So when you classify an epithelium based on the shape of the cells, the only cells that you care about the shape of is in the apical layer. Well, anyway, there are three major kinds of cell shapes that we find in epithelia: squamous, cuboidal, and columnar. All right? Now let me just go to pictures to explain these, because then you get a better idea. So we're in slide 6 now. On the bottom, which is where we're classifying by cell shape, squamous cells are cells that are thinner than they are wide. Now, when I'm talking about width as a direction, a layer of cells, this is what I mean by width. Okay, thickness goes from basal to apical direction. Width goes side to side. So a squamous cell is wider than it is thick. And this would be kind of like a floor tile. If you consider the whole floor made up of many tiles, that's one layer of cells. Each tile is a cell. And they're all thinner, much thinner than they are wide. So those are squamous cells. A cuboidal cell is, as the name implies, like a cube, which means at least roughly the same thickness as it is wide. And then the other extreme, opposite of squamous, is columnar. It's thicker than it is wide, so it's like a little column. All right, now those are the three basic cell shapes and the two schemes of classification. If you want to completely classify an epithelium, you really classify it simultaneously in both of those schemes. So you combine one of the words, either simple or stratified, with one of the words for the shape. And therefore, there's multiple possibilities. You can have a simple squamous epithelium, a simple columnar, a simple cuboidal, or a stratified squamous, a stratified cuboidal, or a stratified columnar. All right? By using the combinations of those words, you're simultaneously categorizing it based on the number of cells, number of layers, and also by the shape of the cells in the apical layer. Now, I didn't talk yet about pseudostratified. First, let's make sure you understand simple and stratified. Simple is just one layer. Stratified, obviously, there's more than one layer of cells here. Pseudostratified literally means falsely stratified, right? Because pseudo means false. And the reason that it's not truly stratified, a pseudostratified epithelium, is that it only looks like there's multiple layers of cells. If you think about an epithelium that has just one layer of cells, this simple one, for it to actually truly only have one layer of cells means that every single cell must be in contact with the basement membrane, right? Because if a cell is built on top of another cell without touching the membrane, that's another layer. Well, in a pseudostratified epithelium, notice that every one of these cells is still in contact with the basement membrane. So it really is just one layer. But what makes it look like multiple layers is that different cells have different thicknesses to them. It's kind of like a carpet with different thicknesses of the fibers, right? They're all still connected to the basement membrane, the mat of the carpet. So that's pseudostratified, and it's strictly speaking, it's a simple epithelium, but it gets the special name pseudostratified because of its appearance. All right. The next several slides can go fairly quickly because they just show you examples of all these possibilities that we just talked about. There's a lot of slides in this show, but it's not going to take as long as it seems like it would take to get through 40 slides or whatever it is. Anyway, we'll start with simple squamous. And a simple squamous epithelium is not only thin because it's simple, right, just one layer, but it's as thin as a simple epithelium can be because squamous cells are thin, right? So simple squamous epithelia are as thin as epithelia can be, and therefore they're very delicate. Doesn't take much to hurt them. You can scratch them and really do some damage. But and therefore they're vulnerable is what I'm saying, but it must be for a good reason that the body would tolerate having such a vulnerable epithelium, and that's because the thinness really makes them work well for something. What it makes them work very well for is diffusion, which we've talked a lot about in this course, moves particles around very well as long as there's a gradient. But it works well only over short distances. If you had to rely on diffusion to move something, you know, the whole height of your body, for instance, that might take tens of years for it to diffuse that far. But over tiny distances, micrometers, then diffusion works really wonderfully quickly. Well, diffusion is how your lungs work, for instance. When you breathe air in, diffusion of two different major types of particles is happening. The air gets put right next to the blood that surrounds the little sacs in your lungs, and that blood is carrying very little oxygen because it's just made a trip through the body. It's delivered its oxygen to the rest of the body. So the air in the air sacs has a higher oxygen concentration than the blood, and therefore oxygen diffuses from the air to the blood. At the same time, that blood is bringing a bunch of CO2 back from the body because the mitochondria have spit out CO2 from the Krebs cycle and from the oxidation of pyruvate. So there's a higher CO2 concentration in the blood than in the air in your lungs, and therefore CO2 diffuses in the opposite direction just because of gradients. Well, that happens so quickly because the epithelium that lines your little air sacs in your lung, the alveoli, is a simple squamous epithelium, ideally suited for that job. And the reason that it can get away with being so delicate is because your lungs are protected by being deep in you, and you know, you're not scratching them. although some people do foolishly smoke. All right, slide 8 is a simple cuboidal epithelium. Still one layer, but notice that the shape of the cells is cuboidal. They're about as thick as they are wide. Now, you find this in, for instance, the kidney. These examples aren't the only places that you find them. But the reason the kidney uses simple cuboidal epithelium is because the kidney has to do a lot of secreting. The kidney filters out whatever is in the blood that is small enough to get through the little pores. That's what your kidney does first. It filters anything that's there, whether it's good or bad. If it's small enough, it gets squeezed out of the blood into the filtrate, which will eventually become the urine. Well, the good stuff that you don't really want to lose needs to be put back into the blood after it's been filtered out. And the kidney does that right after filtration. That requires a lot of transport proteins to move things across cell membranes. And therefore, to build all of those proteins requires quite a bit of cytoplasm in the cell, because that's where the proteins have to be built, inside of cells, right? So you need factories that are big enough to keep up with making up all these proteins, and therefore they can't be as thin as the ones in the lung, basically. So they have to be a little thicker, and you find that in kidneys, for instance. But they're still thin because you don't want to be moving these things through much thickness if you can help it. Slide 9 shows you a simple columnar epithelium. Here you have a good example of the small intestine. And the small intestine has the major function of absorbing food that has been digested. Digestion refers just to breaking down food into molecules, individual molecules, because food particles are way too huge to actually put into your body, to put through the cell membrane of your body's cells. So you digest your food while it's really still outside of your body, but it's in this tube that you surround until it's individual molecules. And then those molecules get absorbed by the small intestine. Well, absorbing is a lot like secreting that the kidney does, meaning that to get these molecules into the cells that line your small intestine and therefore pass them on to the blood so they can be distributed throughout the body, that requires transport proteins as well. And in fact, it requires even more transport proteins than the kidney requires to do its secretion. Because if you don't absorb the nutrients, the molecules of food that you've eaten, while it's passing through your small intestine, you're not going to get another chance to do it, right? It's making its way toward the other end. It'll be waste. So your body, in order to get as much nutrition as possible from the food as it passes through you, your small intestine needs to be as efficient as possible at transporting all those molecules into the cells. Therefore, it needs to be packed full. The membranes of it need to be packed full of transport proteins. Remember when we looked at a tour of the cell and we were talking about microvilli that drastically increases the surface area of a cell that lines the gut? This is one cell. And that drastic increase in surface area means that you can house a lot more transport proteins in there. All those transport proteins are like little turnstiles where the molecules can get into the cell. Well, making that many transport proteins and putting them into the membrane requires a huge amount of machinery to build those, a lot of ribosomes working continuously. And therefore, even though the gut would prefer to be as thin as possible, because that means there's less distance to move those molecules through those cells and then into the blood, they can't be that thin because they can't fit these huge protein factories in such a thin cell. So they have to be columnar, basically, to make all those proteins. All right, but they're still as thin as they can be because they're only one layer thick, right? If they were stratified, that would just be an impediment. All right, now, speaking of stratified, let's go on to some stratified. This is stratified squamous epithelium, and this is what your skin is. Well, actually, not your entire skin. The skin is made up of not only an epithelium, but that epithelium is built on top of a connective tissue layer. So we have the dermis, which means skin. That's not an epithelium, that's connective tissue. And then built on top of that, the part you feel, is the epidermis, which is an epithelium. All right? Well, the epidermis is continuously being exposed to a lot of things that rub it off. It gets abraded continuously. I mean, just the wind blowing on you is removing thousands of cells all the time. But also, you know, you rub it and you knock into things. So the skin is taking a lot of abuse, basically. That's why it's stratified. If it were only one cell layer thick and you're losing cells continuously, you would have holes in your epithelium everywhere, which would expose the underlying things that it's trying to cover. So by having many cell layers, it doesn't matter that you're continuously losing cells from that outer layer because you're continuously adding new cells at the under layer. As a matter of fact, that's where the cells are still alive, where they're born or created by mitosis down here at the basal layer, and then they migrate up and mature and eventually die and harden. And it's what the cells that you touch are old, dead skin cells that are hardened and waterproofed. The living ones are deeper in. But notice the avascularity. The vessels are down here in the connective tissue, the dermis layer. There's no vessels running through this epithelium. Okay, now, by the way, also notice that this is clearly stratified, but the cell shape is different for the different layers. That's why you don't pay attention to what the shape is except for the apical layer when you're classifying the epithelium. So even though all these cells are cuboidal, this is not a stratified cuboidal epithelium. It's stratified squamous because the apical layer, by the time the cells get there, they're squamous cells. All right, then we have stratified cuboidal, multiple layers in which the apical layer is cuboidal, and you find these in glands. For instance, as you see here, the various salivary glands that are in your head producing saliva to make it easier to eat. It lubricates the food as you swallow it, but it also starts digestion. And so they do a lot of secretion, and they therefore need to be, for the same reason kidney cells have to be, they need to be cuboidal. Slide 12 shows you a stratified columnar. And these are actually, you don't see this many places in the body, but notice the micrograph. It is multiple layers, and that outer layer is columnar. So you find this, for instance, mammary gland duct, also the larynx as pictured. But I think you know the general scheme by now. It's stratified, and the apical layer is columnar. Now, 13 is pseudostratified, and I've already given you the definition of that, but this is a different picture of it. Notice still, though, that every one of these different thickness cells is still in contact with the basement membrane. So it's not truly stratified, it's pseudostratified. This one also happens to be ciliated, has cilia on it. I've talked about how the cilia sweep debris from your lungs back up to your throat. So this is part of the trachea. All right, transitional epithelium, slide 14. I haven't talked about this yet, even though it was on that classification table that we started with. Transitional means that it's able to change, right? It's able to undergo a transition. You find this in organs that need to stretch quite a bit. And so the urinary bladder and the ureter, the ureters are the tubes. Each ureter is a tube that leads from a kidney to the urinary bladder. So the urinary bladder receives urine continuously from both ureters coming from the kidney. And the urinary bladder is really just a storage device because you don't want the urine to be leaking out of you continuously. You want to get rid of it all at a convenient time, right? That's what your urinary bladder is for. Well, the urinary bladder is not all that big when it's empty, but it can get enormous. I mean, it's amazing how much it can hold, actually, without bursting. To do that, it needs to stretch a lot. Well, if it were made with a conventional epithelium, you know, if you consider a sphere, consider just a layer of cells all around that sphere, hooked right up against each other like they are in epithelia. When you make that sphere bigger, the circumference is much bigger, right? So that would force cells to tear apart from each other. And once again, you'd have a bunch of holes in that epithelium, right? If you had to make it that big. That would be bad. So the way the body gets around that problem is to have a transitional epithelium. A transitional epithelium starts when it's not stretched as being pretty stratified, so there's many layers of cells, and those cells tend to be pretty columnar. Then when it stretches, which really has the effect of pulling it widthwise, the cells that are in different layers slide down and fill in the holes that would be created if you were allowing those cells to be separated from each other. And they go from more columnar to more squamous as they're stretched. So this allows the thing to stretch without there being any holes in the epithelium, up to a point, of course. It is possible for a urinary bladder to burst, but you usually don't let that happen. All right, that's transitional epithelium. And I think that's it for epithelia. Yes, it is. So we're through one of the four kinds of tissues. And slide 15 brings us to the second one, connective tissues. And now remember I said that connective tissue is the most diverse of the four types of tissue, meaning that within connective tissue there's a big variety of types of specific connective tissue. Whereas, you know, if you think about muscle tissue, yeah, there's different muscles, but they all are pretty much built the same. They're just in different positions. Even heart muscle compared to skeletal muscle, it's still pretty much the same stuff. And all epithelia, they have different shapes, but they're all basically just chock full of cells. Well, connective tissue is not all the same. It looks drastically different. And it includes, you know, probably the two extremes are blood, which is a connective tissue, which is liquid, and bone at the other extreme, which is completely hard stuff. They're both connective tissues, though. So it gets its name for the fact that it does connect a lot of things. For instance, the epithelia are built on connective tissue because connective tissue is connecting that epithelium to something even deeper than that. But they don't all have that function. So like I said, anything that's not nervous tissue, muscle tissue, or epithelial tissue is connective tissue. Despite that variety, though, there are some things that every connective tissue has as a properties. And there's two major components of any connective tissue. That's what the numbers here represent. So any connective tissue has some cells. It has a cellular component. And besides the cells, it has an extracellular matrix. So this is different from epithelia. Remember that first property of epithelia was cellularity, meaning that you really have nothing but cells in an epithelium. Well, in a connective tissue, you do have cells, but you have a lot of stuff outside of those cells as well, between cells. And all of that stuff collectively that is outside of the cells, but is still part of the connective tissue, is called the extracellular matrix. So those are the two primary components, cells and extracellular matrix. Notice from the lettered subheadings of under cells that there are three major types of cells. There are blasts, cytes, and clasts. Now, blasts, and there are different kinds of blasts depending on what connective tissue you're in. For instance, the blasts in a cartilage, which is a connective tissue, it would be a chondroblast, because chondro means cartilage. If it's in a bone tissue, then it's osteoblast, because osteo means bone, and so on. But regardless of whatever the prefix is, a blast is a cell whose job it is to produce extracellular matrix. That extracellular matrix doesn't just pop into existence. It has to be produced by the cells and then released into the spaces between the cells. Well, the job of producing that is the job of the blasts. Now, when a blast does its job completely, in other words, when it's already made enough extracellular matrix, then you really still have the same cell there that you've just previously called a blast, but now that its job changes from producing extracellular matrix to just maintaining it, we change its name into site. So mature blasts become sites. Their job is to maintain the extracellular matrix. But there's a totally different kind of cell that never starts out as a blast, and that's called a clast. Clasts are cells whose job it is to degrade the extracellular matrix, so they destroy it. Connective tissues are not just built and ignored. They're always being built, torn down, and rebuilt continuously in different parts of them. So clasts destroy extracellular matrix, and then that, when you need new extracellular matrix, the blasts take over and make new. Okay, now the extracellular matrix has two major components to it, A and B. And those are ground substance and fibers. Now, fibers are proteins of different types. But remember, the extracellular matrix is totally outside of the cells. So there's no cells in the extracellular matrix. The extracellular matrix is between the cells. And in that extracellular matrix, there's a whole collection of fibers, proteins. But that's not the only thing that makes up extracellular matrix. If you ignore the proteins and consider just the rest of that extracellular matrix, that stuff that those proteins are in is called ground substance. And what it is differs from tissue to tissue. But all connective tissues have a ground substance in which fibers are found to make up the extracellular matrix. All right. Then finally, there are three major kinds of protein fibers that you find in an extracellular matrix: collagenous, elastic, reticular. Collagenous just is the adjective of collagen. Collagen is a protein that animals make that's tough, rope-like stuff. I talked about it before when we first discussed proteins in general. There are elastic fibers that are much more delicate, but they are able to stretch, as the name implies. Collagenous fibers don't stretch because they're not supposed to. Just like you don't want a rope to stretch, you want a rope to hold the tensile strength. You don't want it to stretch. Sometimes you do want something to stretch. Elastic fibers are able to do that, and then when whatever force it is applied that makes them stretch is released, they'll rebound into their original shape, just like a rubber band. Up to a point, of course, they can break. And then there are reticular fibers. Reti, the word reti, R-E-T-E, means a web-like shape or a network. And reticule really just means a small web. So reticular means occurring as a small web. But reticular fibers are able, when you get a bunch of reticular fibers together, they're able to make a net or web-like structure because each individual fiber has a bunch of branches on it. These collagenous and elastic fibers don't have branches. They're like strands. But the reticular fibers have several branches, and when you get a bunch of those together, they make a nice network or web-like arrangement. Okay, that's the general anatomy of any given connective tissue, but there are different kinds of connective tissues, radically different kinds of connective tissues. So let's look at those in slide 16. connective tissue can be classified just like epithelia can, and there's different degrees to the hierarchy of classification. The two primary types of connective tissue are embryonic and adult. And that's pretty self-explanatory. You find embryonic tissue only in the embryo. So very early on, before the person's born, before it even becomes a fetus, you find embryonic tissue. And embryonic tissue, embryonic connective tissue, is not only the first connective tissue that you have as a human, but it eventually develops into all the other kinds of connective tissue. So all the adult connective tissues that are listed here, those all start out very early on as embryonic connective tissue. So mesenchyme, you have mesenchyme and mucous connective tissue. Those are both types of embryonic connective tissues. Mucus, when mucus is spelled this way, by the way, O-U-S, that's an adjective. When you spell mucus, M-U-C-U-S, that's a noun. So mucus, the stuff, is spelled this way. Mucus, O-U-S, means producing mucus. And therefore, embryonic mucus tissue is tissue that produces mucus. All right. Mostly we're going to focus on the adult connective tissues. And so you see that there's six major kinds of those. Loose here, the first one listed, which is also called areolar tissue, is called loose because of the relatively low number of fibers that you find in the extracellular matrix. So it has, in its extracellular matrix, it's mostly ground substance. There aren't all that many fibers in it. And then that does, since there aren't very many protein fibers, it's not very strong stuff. It's packing material mostly. It doesn't have to be strong based on where it is, and we'll look at examples. Then you have dense, which is the opposite of loose. Dense refers to the fact that there's a lot of fibers packed into a small space. So it's much stronger stuff. Well, you can further categorize dense connective tissues based on the type and the arrangement of the fibers. So dense, regular collagenous connective tissue is dense because there's a lot of fibers. It's regular because those fibers are arranged in parallel mostly. They're all running basically the same direction. That's what regular means. And it's collagenous because the type of fibers is collagenous fibers or collagen fibers. That's dense, regular, collagenous. There's dense, regular, elastic. Instead of collagen fibers, it's elastic, but they're still arranged in the same way, and there's a lot of them. Dense, irregular, collagenous means that you're still using collagen fibers, and there's a lot of them. That's why it's dense, but they're not all running the same direction. They're running in all directions. That makes them irregular. And similarly for elastic. So we'll look at pictures in a minute. There are ones with special properties, ones meaning connective tissues, adult connective tissues. These special property ones are adipose tissue and reticular tissue. What is adipose tissue? Yeah. It's tissue that is specialized for storing fat. So the fat that you put on, as whether it's for packing material or thermal insulation, or whether it's just because you're taking in more food than your body needs, for whatever reason you put fat on, that fat occurs in tissue called adipose tissue. And that's a connective tissue. Reticular tissue, as the name implies, includes a lot of reticular fibers. And because it forms that net-like arrangement, works as a little filter, basically. And so you find this in your lymph nodes, which one of the jobs of lymph nodes is to trap any invaders like bacteria and give your immune system a chance to kill them. All right, next major category of adult connective tissue is cartilage. And there are different kinds of cartilages. Cartilage is pretty hard stuff. It's not as hard as bone, though, but it is hard stuff. Pretty tough. The three major kinds of cartilage are hyaline cartilage, fibrocartilage, and elastic cartilage. And I'll show you the differences of those when we have pictures. It doesn't really make sense to explain them right here. Then we have bone, which is the hardest connective tissue. And bone comes in two major varieties. Cancellous, and another name for that is spongy, and compact. And I'll explain why they have those names with pictures. And then finally, the sixth major type of adult connective tissue is blood and hemopoietic tissue. Now, hemopoietic is the adjective of hemopoiesis. Hemo always refers to blood. Hemoglobin is part of the blood, right? Hemopoiesis is the process of producing blood cells. Not just red blood cells, all blood cells. Now, most of the cells in your blood are red blood cells, but you also have several categories of white blood cells. They all come from the same kinds of cells, stem cells that are able to produce any of the kinds, and those cells are in your marrow. Well, those are since those cells produce the blood cells, they're called hemopoietic cells. And that's a connective tissue. I mean, they are part of a connective tissue. All right, let's look at some pictures now. Slide 17. This is just a catch-all picture to show you that these drastically different kinds of connective tissue are found all over the body, not just in the leg of this wolf. For instance, you have tendons, which need to be really strong to withstand all that strength. They are fibrous connective tissue made up of a bunch of fibers, in other words. You have blood traveling through the body everywhere. That's a connective tissue. Various cartilages between the bones. The bones themselves are connective tissue. Plus you have paddings of fat, which are adipose tissue. All of that is connective tissue. Okay, now let's look at some specific pictures. 18. This is mesenchyme, which, remember, is embryonic connective tissue. And it's the main type of embryonic connective tissue. So mesenchyme is the stuff that is not very differentiated at first, embryonically, but it develops along with the embryo into all the other connective tissues that we call adult connective tissues. Mucous connective tissue is the other major kind of embryonic tissue, and like I said, its job is to produce mucus. Okay, but let's go to the adult connective tissues. Slide 20 starts with loose connective tissue. Remember I said that's also called areolar connective tissue. And when you look at the slide, the big picture here, you can see that it's loose. Loose meaning not all that many fibers are present. You also don't see all that many cells. Each one of these dark things is a nucleus of a cell. But the cells aren't packed together like they are in an epithelium. There's a lot of extracellular matrix. But because it's loose, meaning not many fibers, most of that extracellular matrix is ground substance. So it's not strong stuff, but it doesn't need to be strong. And because of its looseness, it's able to move around quite a bit. So it's used as packing material deep in the skin. You know, your skin, as you move your body around, your skin needs to glide in different directions across the things that it covers. Your skin needs to be able to do that. And it's able to do that because of a layer of loose connective tissue that basically is kind of like jelly, lets it slide around without damaging anything. Okay, slide 21 is dense, regular, collagenous connective tissue. And like I said, it's dense because it has a lot of fibers. It's regular because those fibers are oriented in the same direction, as you see here. And those fibers are collagen fibers, so it's collagenous connective tissue. And this is really strong stuff. You find this in tendons. Tendons connect muscles to bones. Ligaments, by the way, connect bones to other bones. That's the difference between a ligament and a tendon, but they're made out of the same stuff. Dense, regular, collagenous connective tissues. And the reason that it makes sense for them to be regular for a tendon, meaning oriented in the same direction, is that a tendon, since it connects a muscle to a bone, is always going to be pulled on by the same direction. It only has to be strong in that same direction all the time. Right? If you were to separate it this way, it would be easy to do. But it never gets pulled that way naturally, because the muscle is always pulling on it in one direction only. So it's regular. Slide 22, dense, regular, elastic connective tissue. Once again, they're aligned, and there's a lot of them, but instead of them being collagen fibers, they are elastic fibers. And a good example of this are what are called your vocal folds, or what most non-biologists call vocal cords. That's in your larynx or your voice box, and they're like little guitar strings. When the air rushes past them, they vibrate, and that's what gives you your voice. So it makes sense that they're elastic. They need to be able to be strummed, in a sense. They need to be able to stretch a little bit. Next is dense, irregular collagenous connective tissue. So now we don't have the fibers running in just one direction, we have them running in all directions. And the reason that you would want to do that, if you were designing something, is so that that structure can be pulled on from various directions and still hold up. Well, you find that in the skin. The skin, like I said, is being tugged at in all directions, depending on what your body's doing. It doesn't need to be strong just in one direction and be able to tear in the other. So the connective tissue, the fibers are irregular in arrangement, and therefore it holds up regardless of which direction it's being pulled from. So that's what the dermis primarily is made of. This under the deeper layer of the skin that your epithelium is built on, that we call the epidermis. All of this stuff is dermis. Dense, irregular elastic connective tissue, shown in 24. Elastic is the key word here, right? There's a lot of fibers. That's what makes it dense. But they are elastic fibers, so they're able to stretch. Well, the aorta, which is the largest artery in the body, coming straight out of the heart, out of the left ventricle of the heart, which is the most important chamber because it pumps blood to the entire body other than the lungs. Well, it's a huge artery even when it's not being stretched, depending on the person, but it's that big around coming out of the heart. So a huge tube. Well, when the left ventricle contracts, it squeezes all the blood that's in it into the aorta quickly, all at once. And that bulges the aorta out like a balloon. It receives all this blood at once. Before the blood can actually travel through it, it basically squeezes the aorta out. And therefore, the aorta is made of elastic cartilage arranged in all directions so that it can be squeezed like a balloon in all directions. And it actually does balloon up every single heartbeat. Then, because it's elastic, the aorta goes back into its original shape, just like letting go of a blown up balloon. It's going to recoil. And that's, if you think about this tube, has open end at the heart and away from the heart. If it squeezes back into its normal shape, it's going to just push that liquid in both directions at once, right? So it pushes it back toward the heart and it pushes it away from the heart. But the heart has a valve on it, so when it tries to push it back into the heart, it runs into a dead end, and therefore that recoil, that elastic recoil that the aorta has, actually acts like a secondary heart and pushes it even stronger on its way toward the body. So elastic fibers do a good job in propelling the blood. It's not the only place you see it, but whoops, I went back one. It's not the only place you see it, but it's the best example. All right, next, 25 is adipose tissue. And adipose tissue is tissue that stores fat, like I said. Now, compared to most connective tissues, adipose tissue does have quite a few cells. Doesn't have all that much extracellular matrix, even though there is some. And you see here a bunch of what look like empty cells here. The reason they look like they're empty is because when you prepare a slide with stain so that it shows up well, you dissolve the fat that's in it. So they are empty at this point. But in a living human, these would be full of fat. all these empty spaces would be filled with fat. And these cells that are specialized for storing fat are called adipocytes, literally meaning lipid cells or fat cells. And so you find this throughout the body. It's important to have fat in the body for various reasons. For padding, so that organs, important organs, are not damaged when they move around. Also for thermal insulation, but importantly to store energy, because fat is the most energy-dense nutrient. It stores more than twice as much energy per gram than carbohydrates or proteins do. All right. 26 is reticular tissue. And this is one of those ones with special properties. Well, just like adipose was, the previous one. But remember I said they occur in lymph nodes. This green thing is a lymph node. And if you look at it even closer than you have it here, you see a bunch of reticular fibers forming a little sieve or filter. Lymph is fluid that escapes from the bloodstream. So we all know about our blood vessels, but a lot of people don't realize we have a whole separate set of vessels running alongside those blood vessels called lymphatic vessels that carry fluid that used to be in the blood but got squeezed out of the blood because of the blood pressure. That fluid escapes the blood vessels, and if it were allowed to remain outside the blood vessels, it would cause edema. It would just, more and more swelling would occur, and eventually you'd die. So you need a whole separate set of tubes to collect that stuff that's been squeezed out of the bloodstream and then return it to the bloodstream up here in the shoulders, in major arteries in the veins in the shoulders. That's one major job of the lymphatic system. But the system of lymphatic vessels has hundreds of lymph nodes along the way, which are like little exits in the highway where the lymph is filtered, because things that can invade you, like bacteria, can make their way into the blood and then into the lymph. And then there are specialized white blood cells that stick around in the lymph nodes to recognize these invading cells as part of your immune system and kill them. Well, the reticular fibers make it easy for the lymph node to collect these things and give the white blood cells a chance to kill them. All right, we'll stop there.